Recorded on location at Aspen Ideas Health in Aspen, Colorado.
Our guest is the president of the Commonwealth Fund, which has a strong focus on health equity and resources to support its version for everyone in America.
We also see some troubling signs. In fact, we see that vaccination rates have dropped, childhood vaccination rates have dropped in every single state since 2019, and infant mortality has increased in 20 states.
Dr. Joseph Betancourt is nearly 3 years into his role leading the fund. He has some important insights at this pivotal moment in our country as we think about how to provide and how to pay for health services.
I think we've reached a tipping point. You know, Americans across the country are having incredible difficulty accessing primary care.
Yeah.
And providers are as frustrated as patients. So we have a unique opportunity, I think, to leverage that frustration to some action.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Dr. Betancourt, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me and look forward to the conversation.
And we are here at Aspen Ideas Health and got to say thank you for the Commonwealth Fund support of this really important conversation that goes on over the next couple of days.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Certainly.
And, you know, we've had the opportunity to have Karen Davis and Dr. Blumenthal on the show. We're really familiar with the Commonwealth Fund. I'm not sure everybody in the country, they should be. And I'm wondering if you might share some of your mission, vision, and values of the fund.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Karen and David are mentors, icons, and friends. So it's an honor to be invited to continue that legacy of representation here at Aspen. So the Commonwealth Fund was established in 1918. And it's important to call out that it was established by a woman, Anna Harkness.
Right.
The Harkness family was lucky enough to be very generous with the resources that they had acquired through investments in Standard Oil and through incredible generosity of Anna Harkness. $10 million was leveraged to start the Commonwealth Fund. Commonwealth Fund in its early days, with its focus on doing well for the common good, funded some incredible work. The first public health departments.
That's right.
First rural hospitals that led to the Hill-Burton Act. The first advanced practice practitioner programs. We've done work in our early days as well on the first palliative care service. Really incredibly innovative work, first medical schools in urban areas. So the list goes on and on. In the last 25 years, it's been a pivot more to health policy. And our mission is affordable, high quality health care for everyone.
Yeah.
We're part think tank, part do tank, where we provide grants to advance improving coverage, improving care, addressing healthcare costs, of course, making sure we leave no one behind, so improving equity.
Yeah.
And we have some international learning and exchange that's part of our portfolio of work. So it's an exciting time. Certainly, I'm thrilled to be part of such a, I think, well-regarded institution that has provided in a nonpartisan way, but in a very well-respected way, evidence to shape policy. Most recently, some of the evidence that helped lead to the Affordable Care Act. So here we are in another time where we're trying to raise our voice and bring our science to bear in a time where we're facing some pretty challenging decisions around coverage, care cost, and equity.
Yeah, I know that list is long. I think child guidance I would add to the
certainly
to the area that you really were a seminal leader in the field.
Yep. Oh yeah, I'm giving it short shrift. I mean, it's more than 100 years of, I think, trying to really make a difference for all Americans.
That's
and
right.
Also trying to share and learn from international partners.
Yeah.
I think it's really time that we have that humility to understand that we don't have it all worked out. I think many, many Americans understand that we have a lot to do, and there are ways in which we can learn from other places. And so, you know, that's an important part of our work.
Well, we really appreciate the history that you shared, and we like to honor our ancestors and the founding of organizations.
Perfect.
And know that that legacy lives on. So thank you. And you've just released your scorecard on state health system performance.
Yes.
And this is an important contribution, I think, that the fund makes. We'd love for you to maybe tell us a little bit about the report itself. How long have you been doing it? What's the goal? And of course, what are the findings that you're seeing during this important time?
Yeah, so I've inherited just a wonderful team that creates a series of report cards and scorecards that do everything from compare the U.S. to international partners to rank all 50 states on things like quality and outcomes and access, equity scorecards, women's health scorecards.
Yep.
So really incredible work, and I think important. We have just released our state scorecard, which ranks all 50 states on a series of measures, public data, in three areas, as I mentioned previously, looking at outcomes, looking at access, and looking at quality. And I think what we see is more of the same as it relates to the states that are high performing and low performing. But let me just take a step back and say, big picture. We have really demarcated unprecedented healthcare coverage insurance gains. Unprecedented, right. 93 to 94% of Americans with insurance. We see that in our state scorecard, incredibly important. Despite that, we also see some troubling signs. In fact, we see that vaccination rates have dropped, childhood vaccination rates have dropped in every single state since 2019, and infant mortality has increased in 20 states. So while we have historic coverage gains and people able to get the care they need in much better ways and more than in the past, we also have these troubling signs that I think are even more challenging given some of the decisions that are being made now in Washington. I'll end just by saying that we, year after year, can identify the critical success factors between states that are high performing and low performing. It's investment in coverage. Massachusetts, mm-hmm. routinely number one, has invested in universal coverage. It's greater investment in the social drivers of health. And certainly, I think we're all trying to do more by way of primary care investment. Yeah. And the states that end up on the lower side clearly demonstrate that not only federal policy matters, but state policy matters. Right. That's why we see those differences.
And there's some nuance in that. You have a Mississippi, which might be low, but scores well on investment in primary care, right? I mean,
That's right. It's
a nuanced report, which I find interesting. Maybe just pulling the thread on the immunization side, there are seven, I guess, recommended doses for children. 75% of the country or the states have them all, but you were trying to pull the thread on why. What's the reason? It wasn't all about misinformation, was it?
Yeah.
What were some of the other factors?
Well, I mean, I think misinformation certainly plays a role. There's no doubt that the pandemic and everything that transpired around COVID vaccinations and mandates and closing schools and that entire, I think, set of situations that we faced, it did. It did create likely greater hesitancy among people, asking more questions. I think that we also understand that during that time, also in addition to the concerns that people had, there was some misinformation that was mm-hmm. put forth. Mm-hmm. Accessibility and availability, I think, become an issue as well. But at the end of the day, when we think about the biggest and most impactful public health interventions of our history, vaccinations is top three, along
Absolutely.
With sanitation and antibiotics.
Right, absolutely.
So, you know, we are in favor, again, of providing evidence and science. And certainly I, as a primary care doctor, want to make sure that the vaccines that I'm recommending to my patients are safe.
Of course.
So, you know, having that discernment is something that we welcome. By the same token, many, many, many of these vaccines have been tested over and over again and have been shown to save lives. And some estimates, 500 million lives across the globe.
That's
right. So this is an important time for us to really bring that science forward.
I'm glad you mentioned sewage. My dad was a water chemist, always reminded me that the big changes in life expectancy happened with the onset of indoor plumbing.
Of course, we're from the state that put fluoride in the water for the first time too. So,
you know, that's
we can talk a lot about water.
Critically important. I think I'm doing a panel tomorrow on reimagining public health. Public health doesn't, people on the ground, they don't understand the incredible public health interventions that are happening around them that they don't see, hear, and feel because we don't constantly tout that.
Yeah.
Sanitation is a basic one. We take a lot of things for granted. Clean water, I mean, the list goes on, but major public health interventions.
Well, let me ask an unfair question because you're just going through your first change of administration, but over the time, the Commonwealth has always dealt with administrations that come in and make changes.
Yep.
And that just happens. That's the nature of the reality. What do you do internally in terms of your planning process? Because you probably have a game plan that arches over all of these.
Yep.
But at the same time, there are some tactical decisions to make. Certainly, you're a leader in the field. How are you thinking about?
Yep, no doubt. It's preparation, preparation, preparation. Mm-hmm. We began, well before the election, deep into, I'd say early, shall I say, but many, many, many months ago, into 2024. Engaging, because it's nonpartisan, our goal is engagement. Engaging individuals who are going to be involved in either administration with the notion that engagement is something we want. We did want to get perspectives about what the different ideas were around health policy on both sides, and really having a game plan for both sides and how they might bring forward health policy. Yep. And so that preparation really helped us. We understood that things like work requirements and Medicaid were absolutely coming. We understood that on the bright side, there was an interest in primary care right. and an interest in prevention. Right. So that preparation really helped us. And we have built trusting relationships with individuals who have connections and are, in many cases, part of the administration sure. and want to add value to their decisions. Sure. So I think that's...
Find that seam of commonality.
That's right.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah, I mean, our goal is improving the health of the American people. Yeah. Agnostic to which political party is doing it. Yep. But steadfast in our mission and vision and values to provide that evidence that's needed to make sure that we are committed to the health right. of all American people. Mm-hmm.
And part of that mission, vision, and values is you need data.
Yep.
And you note that in the scorecard that there's some threats to public data, and that data is part of what helps us to look at health system performance. And while I could take an educated guess at what kind of data might be missing or difficult to obtain, we'd like to hear it from you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of big data sets, particularly out of the CDC, series of data sets that really provide key information on public health, on health outcomes, on hospital outcomes, and a big one on health equity. You know, certainly we understand, and our commitment at the Commonwealth Fund is to make sure everyone, no matter who they are, where they're from, how much money they make, gets the best we have to offer, and we leave no one behind.
Right.
Sadly, what we've seen is a lot of the data that's been stripped away prevents us from really being able to assess the national landscape, find out where the gaps are, and think about where interventions might be. Right. So this is a major challenge, and we're working with partners like Academy Health mm-hmm. to figure out, is there opportunities to stand up data sets, lift up data sets, try to advocate for the preservation of data sets. But, you know, we cannot navigate without information.
That's right.
And so clearly data is important, and we lament any efforts to pull data back that prevents us from monitoring the health of the American people.
I think we've seen the same thing in the community health center system, 30 million patients, the uniform data set report, which yeah. had ample data on all the characteristics that you're speaking of, being pulled back for a while. We're hoping that comes back, because that's very important data for you totally. As well, given the focus of the patient population.
Yeah, and it's data, and that data needs to be taken care of by people, right? So right. the reduction in forces as well in HHS are concerning. So there's a lot of things that are concerning around our ability to, again, to monitor and improve the health of the American people. But the data one is certainly yeah. one that's really critical to us, as we think we play an important role there.
And it's so important to underscore, you're looking at everyone in the country.
No doubt.
There's no red states, no blue states. Every
right.
state
no doubt.
Is what you're looking at. And talk a little bit about the blueprint for health equity. And when was it published? And what do you think the timeline will be for implementation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we began to talk about this notion that really health equity, and it's evolved. I'll just say it's evolved because, sadly, what we see is there's been a weaponization of even the simple term health equity
right.
and a co-opting of that narrative. I spent my career doing work on health equity in red and blue states. And ultimately, what I've been able to do as I engage with people in of all different political persuasions is to say that we collectively care about doing exactly what I mentioned previously, making sure that any individual who enters our hospital, no matter who they are, where they're from, gets evidence-based clinical guidelines yeah. and the best care. This notion of an equity blueprint is one that simply says we need to, number one, have good data to identify where gaps are. Number two, we need to take action to fill those gaps and monitor our progress. Strategic planning, measurement, continued quality improvement intervention is essential. And we never for once said this is just about black people or brown people or right. those people or those people. It's about all people, and that's the fabric of our nation. So this blueprint, I think, is as we evolve it now, we're trying to be more precise with what we mean when we talk about health equity. We think that's really, really critical, and give examples of differences or disparities that impact people in rural settings, right. that impact women, people with disabilities, people who have low socioeconomic status, just to kind of... I think reclaim that narrative and provide that precision and clarity.
Well, I want to pick up on the regional thought, because it's been clear in the last couple of months as we've had the conversation about Medicaid, There have been nice reports about every congressional district and the level of Medicaid recipients in them. And you can see it knows no boundaries,
yes.
Right? And I think it's getting back to this issue of lies, damn lies, and statistics. We want the data to really unite us, not to divide us.
That's right. I mean, it's paradoxical in many cases. I mean, some of the, some regions that are the reddest, in many cases have the most Medicaid recipients.
That's right.
And so this doesn't just track by blue or red, and we want the best for all. So ultimately, I think we're trying to provide the evidence around if and how you change Medicaid. These are the impacts: economic, impact on rural hospitals, impact on all people, not just those with Medicaid, impact on the economy, impact on jobs. We feel that's our responsibility. So whether you're trying to make enrollment or re-enrollment harder, whether you're trying to leverage work requirements, whether you're trying to cut back on certain payments in the name of fraud, waste, and abuse, we have no problem with addressing fraud, waste, and abuse, but we do need to be very clear about the impact of some of these changes and the potential loss of insurance of 14 to 16 million Americans.
It's a huge, huge number. Are you working with the National Governors Association? How do you sort of orchestrate, if you don't mind us getting the inside
Absolutely.
The Beltway view yeah. of who you're working with, who are your strategic partners?
Absolutely. So, we just recently, within the last couple of weeks, had a visit to Washington, D.C. We have a great partnership with NASHP, the National Academy of State Health Policymakers, where we brought with NASHP in partnership and with the Milbank Foundation as well, Milbank Fund, about 30 leaders of health and human services from across the country.
Yeah.
And brought them to D.C. We meet, we strategize, we have discussions. And when I say strategize, just sharing, really, in that convening. But we had a chance to spend an hour with Dr. Oz over at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Yeah.
Very, very productive conversation. Clearly, I think we were able to, the state directors, in fact, were able to provide their perspectives on what some of these changes would mean for them operationally, from an execution standpoint, from a cost standpoint. I think Dr. Oz really listened. It was clear. He said, we are not trying to create barriers to kick people off Medicaid. We're trying to make sure that Medicaid dollars go to those who are most vulnerable. Fair. He talked about work requirements and things like it's not just work. It could be community volunteer.
That's right.
So, we had a really great dialogue. And I think dialogue is what we want. And these types of engagements allow us to find common ground. He had a lot of learnings from that group who said, how are we going to, these data sets, eligibility for SNAP is different than for Medicaid.
Right.
Doing this enrollment, I mean, this is a big thing. It's not just flip a switch on work requirements or the like. Great conversation. That's the
And they're going to have to implement it.
No doubt.
CMS is going to.
Could be millions of dollars, incredible additional red tape. So, at a time where you're trying to, kind of limit bureaucracy, you could add a whole lot more.
Right.
Good exchange, and that's what we aim to foster.
Margaret, we just had a great conversation with Stephanie Carlton, the deputy administrator, who really talked about exactly what Dr. Betancourt was saying about this. We want to work together, particularly on the worker requirements.
And you've been a champion of primary care for your whole career. I know you trained as an internist, right?
But still practice.
Good. Champion of primary care. And you've made it clear you think there's reforms that we need in payment and there's investments that we need to make. You also referenced the Milbank Fund, who I've worked with on their work on primary care shortage. I'm sure you've seen the report, Nobody Will See You Now,
right?
The play on the old, the doctor will see you now. What are your top strategies for addressing the primary care crisis that's evolving, even in the presence of people having insurance, not having access to a primary care service?
So I'm a practicing primary care doctor still. I see patients for a half day a week. I practice for almost 25 years. I'd say a couple of things. We are in the midst of a very significant primary care crisis.
Right.
If we just disentangle a couple of pieces from a workforce standpoint, we know that we lost 10% of the primary care workforce from 2005 to 2015, even before the pandemic. 21 to 22, we lost another 16,000 primary care doctors. Average age of a primary care doctor is now 60 years old. We have a really very, very significant administrative burden on our primary care doctors, and I would argue demoralization. The simple notion that I want to do the most and best for my patient, and I can't because people are getting in the way, and this is incredibly demoralizing. You line that up with the fact that there are no reinforcements coming behind us. Medical students are not choosing primary care for all these reasons.
Right. We see the graph.
Yeah, not to mention
dermatology
loan and debt. And so we have a challenge here. Now, we at the Commonwealth Fund have had a program on primary care that's really talked about pushing value-based payment, supporting the community health centers, doing those types of things. We're going to redouble that effort now with the launching of our new strategic plan in September. We're going to focus on primary care and rural health, where primary care issues are even more challenging.
Right.
But I think we've reached a tipping point. You know, Americans across the country are having incredible difficulty accessing primary care.
Yeah.
And providers are as frustrated as patients. So we have a unique opportunity, I think, to leverage that frustration to some action. Now, sadly, when I go to the Hill, what we hear from many leaders on the Hill is we don't hear from primary care doctors enough. Specialists show up here and talk to us a lot about payment and all those things.
The primary care providers are too busy seeing patients.
Yeah, they don't, right? So we're not hearing from them. Squeaky wheel does get the grease. So, you know, I think we also, in addition to value-based payment, we're thinking about ways in which we can amplify what the workforce might be. Earlier session today, talking about community health workers, navigators, healthcare coaches, of course, nurse practitioners, advanced practice practitioners. We have international models that demonstrate when you put all those people in a team, particularly in a value-based setting, you know, you get great results. And so how do we drive towards that? But I would argue, as a practicing clinician, it's not just about payment. I think my peers, you know, paying them a little more is not going to get the
satisfaction.
They need system change.
Yeah.
They want to be able to find meaning in the care they provide and be able to provide care to their patients at a level that's high quality. And so we're trying to level that all in and also really think about technology. We're very bullish on the impact of technology and how it could help us.
Well, you've made so many great points there. I just want to pick up on a couple of them. One, nurse practitioners and physician assistants. Margaret set up the first nurse practitioner residency program 16 years ago, so we're invested in that.
Commonwealth was a big supporter.
Very good.
There are now 500 of them across the country and growing, and that's an important one. But, you know, it's the loan issues that are looming large, and one of the provisions in the new bill is to cap medical school education at $125,000, which may be 1 or 2 years. But not 4 years. And we understand that they're trying to get costs more affordable because we want to attract a diverse group of population into this field. Yeah. What are your thoughts in terms of the financing that's going to be needed? I'd say that, and also the scholarship, you know, the money to keep people in the field in terms of special populations, making sure they're working for those who are interested, have the financial support for working in underserved communities.
Yeah, loan and debt are very, very significant. We do know that it is critical to train people in community settings and provide them the incentives, because at the end of the day, if you have big loans and debt, that's going to force your hand.
Yeah.
I mean,
where
it's
you
about
practice.
Survival, where you practice, the practice you choose, who you choose to care for. And many people say, I'd love to do X, but I just can't. And we don't want it. Number one, we need people taking care of individuals in rural settings and vulnerable populations. And number two, it's a shame if we have people who want to do it and can't do it because of these extenuating factors. This is going to require a significant transformation. And I think tied to this is how medical education will need to dramatically change as well with technology. I mean, we have to acknowledge that in the next 3 to 5 years, 7 years, in my view, care will be drastically different. I think we will see a reimagining of what primary care looks like, where we have chunks of, I believe, things that primary care doctors do now taken off their plates, done, managed in a team-based way, very, very effectively, at a very high and, I think, level of excellence. But the medical training, we need to adapt to that. And like all things healthcare, we have a lot of deeply entrenched systems, I think, that are resistant to these changes. And, you know, these changes are going to happen whether the systems acquiesce or not. But I think the training and the debt and how this plays out is going to be really critical going forward.
Yeah. You know, philanthropy is so important. And I asked you earlier about what you're doing with Governors Association or other groups. Wondering about other foundations across the country, how you're working with them, and some of these small ones, and how are you working to cultivate philanthropy?
Yep.
We need this next generation, and primary care is where we hope they invest, but we also hope they get engaged somewhere where they're interested. What are you doing to sort of tie together with the philanthropy community and also trying to think about cultivating a different culture for giving?
Yeah, so I've been in this role, again, a little bit less than 3 years. I'm a big believer in collaboration. We have big problems. I can't solve it with $25 million in grant making.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't have pride of ownership either. I think at the end of the day, we have had examples of very strong collaboratives. We were part of something called the 7F, which is high need, high cost, older Americans. That began just as that was phasing out. We now have a collaborative of over 10 foundations who are working on primary care. We need this. And quite frankly, I think these crises create opportunity for greater collaboration.
Yeah.
We as foundations have also come together in the defense of our resources as we've had in the bills of potential increase
some of
in
taxes.
Our tax.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's created greater connectivity between the foundations. And I think it's connected to some foundations that are right, left, and center. You know, when I say right, left, and center, I mean leaning. Of course, many of them are nonpartisan, but of course,
University of Texas and Harvard are going to be treated the same way.
Yeah.
And they may have different political stripes.
Ultimately, there's opportunities for leveraging philanthropy. We're never going to fill some of the gaps like the NIH cuts.
Right.
But can we leverage our convening power to really think about what is the right path forward, not just stop right. that, don't do right. that, let's right. not do that.
Right.
Because I think we have to acknowledge it wasn't perfect.
Right.
Clearly, there's a lot of disruption and I'd say some destruction in what's happening right now. But what we really need is a plan forward quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think philanthropy could help catalyze that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure that we always see where we're going as we're going. And I think one of the phenomena of the last several years that kind of came to roost, we saw it in Massachusetts, we saw it in Connecticut, we've seen it in other states, is the role of private equity
yeah.
in healthcare, both at the hospital and tertiary level, but also at the primary care level.
Yeah.
We think over here about some of the pressure that primary care teams are feeling, and that private equity role seems to be exerting influence there as well.
Yeah.
Does the fund have a position on that? Have you done
Absolutely.
Any studies or looked at the impact specifically of that? And we could describe it, but I think everybody knows what we mean.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, we have done work on, again, the science behind private equity with a particular interest in when private equity engages in healthcare delivery, what is the impact on cost, quality, and safety? And we've done work in that space, published in that space. We are launching as part of our strategic plan under our cost pillar, an area that's focusing on what have been called the commercial drivers of health.
Uh-huh.
And the simple notion that many people are feeling that there's a tension between profit and patients
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That has been played out probably in its worst case with the national story of Steward Healthcare,
right.
where really you have wealth extraction at the expense of health creation.
Yeah.
And again, we want the evidence to take us to the rightful conclusion, but the evidence to date, not all private equity investment is the same, not all private equity investors are the same, but we do believe that we want to make sure that people are acting with the American people's health and well-being in mind, and there's accountability for that. It's not about over-regulating, but it is about making sure that we don't see Steward healthcare type situations again, yeah. where hospitals close, communities are left
That's
without
right.
clinicians, and an incredible amount of wealth has been extracted out of those
right.
hospitals. And so it's complex, but we're there and we're going to stay there.
One of the most right. pressing problems of our day. It was mentioned in the Commonwealth announcement of your ascension to the presidency that you are of Latino descent.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could share with us that exciting news and what does it mean for you?
Yeah, you know, this is a great opportunity. I mean, I think for me, my lived experience informs a lot of my ideas around how our foundation can go forward. And it's lived experience that really is about respect. It's about making sure, again, that we leave no one behind. It is about making sure that I and we do the best for everyone. Those are the values that I bring yeah. personally. Those are the values that I bring as a clinician. And those are the values that are very well aligned with the Commonwealth Fund. So it's an honor and a privilege to bring my set of kind of cultural, professional, personal values and experiences to a place that has that alignment and try to think about just making us more impactful. It is, you know, working at the fund and getting a chance to lead the fund, it's what I call a beautiful puzzle. The pieces yeah. are all there. How do we put the puzzle better, put it together in a way that's even better than it was before?
Yeah.
I think all those things inform how we think about it. And we have a fantastic team who's aligned as well.
You know, I have to ask you, I followed your work. I think we probably both did because we were doing the same thing in Connecticut during COVID-19.
Yes.
And you took on a very strong leadership role in community health
yep.
And in the Mass General system. What are the enduring lessons that you learned from that? Because it wasn't about what went on in our exam rooms. It was
no,
all about external to
it
that.
It was incredible. I mean, I'd say a couple things just related to that. When we think about care, and the pandemic really shone a light on this, We need to think about doorstep to bedside and back. Our inability to prevent the spread of COVID in essential workers, people taking public transportation, people in multi-generational housing, not kind of doing work in that space, led to the incredible imbalance at the bedside. And so bringing that holistic view is really important. And I think that's one of the key lessons. I think another really important key lesson that we learned during the pandemic is, man, when stuff's on fire, how quickly people will move. The amount of red tape
I think we would completely agree with you.
And this
innovation.
Innovation and this universal focus on every minute is a life. We used to laugh during the pandemic and we'd say, you remember the days where you and I would say, okay, yeah, let's set up a phone call in a week. No, let's set up a phone call in 1 hour.
On Sunday,
with 100
5 a.m. With 100 people, because every minute matters. And I think I do want to tie that to the demoralization piece, because the pandemic for many caregivers was the worst of times for all the reasons we know, but it was the best of times because all this stuff was out of the way.
That's exactly
and then when you
right.
come back out of that, adrenaline-infused exhaustion, but exhilaration that, you know, along the way you save some lives and now you have to deal with prior approvals, it's really tough.
Yeah.
And so can we get that secret sauce again? Can we deploy that type of energy around behavioral health?
Yeah.
Another pandemic.
Yeah.
Maternal health.
Yeah.
Another pandemic.
Yeah.
So those are the big lessons for me.
Great.
Perfect.
Well, Dr. Betancourt, thank you for sharing a light on the work that Commonwealth Fund is doing and for the leadership that you're providing.
Thank you.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us. And you can find us on YouTube or X or subscribe wherever you can. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you
Dr.
both
Betancourt,
so much.
Yeah, thank you for all of your work.
Thank you. Really appreciate the conversation.
Oh, that's
thank
great.
You.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.